Welcome to the Pillar Podcast. I'm Eric Smith, the founder and president of the Pillar Seminary, joined today by Scott Booth.
Hello.
Scott is our resident OT nerd, and Scott has brought the topic of the day. Bring it on, big boy.
So the topic today comes out of Psalm 1 and a question I had starting grad school about the initial verses in this psalm. So I'll just read the first couple verses here, and it's out of the ESV. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. So I want to stop there. One of the things that really threw me when I read that is I thought, has this author read the law of the Lord?
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it's not super delightful. So that was a big chunk of the reason I went to grad school, was to try to figure out what this guy was on about. How can the law of the Lord be a delight or something that would make you happy or blessed? So you work with the Torah class a bunch on law and how to interpret law and what relevance this has for the believer today, and how that helps us approach the Gospels and things like that. So,
right. Before we get to Torah, I feel the need to say the word there is really happy. I think sometimes we translate it blessed because somehow it feels too mundane to say happy or something.
It's like the guy Asher.
I know.
Asher, right?
Yeah. But Hebrew has different words for happy and blessed, and it is not the word blessed there.
Yeah. So it's even it makes it even worse.
Yeah.
So I'm supposed to be happy reading law.
Yeah, right.
So I want to get to a spot where we can start discussing some laws and what they mean. But before we do that, let's talk about some theory, it sounds really boring. Let's talk about a couple approaches to law and try to find an approach to law that is in line with what the text is actually expecting from you. So talk to me.
Okay, well, our normal approach, what seems intuitive to us when we approach law, is what is referred to by scholars as a statutory law approach. Statutory law basically means that the text is the law. And that's how we operate in our courts.
You like know, it's a list of statutes?
Yeah, yeah. And that those statutes have to be followed to the letter of the law. And that if you have a precedent, that helps you decide a case because you follow the direct legalese or legal precedent according to the letter of the law.
All right. So in that one sentence, I'm slowly fading. Can you give me an example of like
yes.
Give me an example from modern law of like a statutory thing going
on. Yeah. It's kind of easier to give an example even from the Bible, actually. So, for example, Peter says that a woman's beauty shouldn't come from outward adornment, such as stuff, right? You know, wearing a jewelry and fancy hair and all that kind of thing.
Right. So what's the statutory approach?
The statutory approach is, he says, don't let your beauty come from the outward adornment. So don't do outward adornment. But what Peter is saying is don't do your hair. So ladies, if you wear makeup, wear jewelry, do your hair, like to wear decent clothes, you're somehow disobeying that command.
Because we approach it as if
the text is the law.
The text is the law. So there's some approach apparently that suggests the text isn't the law. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's correct. From a common law point of view, which would be the norm in the ancient world, especially in the Old Testament
times. So you're contrasting statutory law versus common law.
Right.
Okay.
Common law is more like when you have these texts, you're looking at applications of some specific principle. You know, so it'd be like if I have a young child and I say, "Hey, don't play in the street." I at the end of the day, I don't really care about playing in the street or not playing in the street. What I care about is my kid not getting hit by a car. So let's pretend that I could somehow block off the street so that no cars were going to be going on that road. Do I really care if my kid plays on the street? No, playing on the street isn't the issue. Don't play on the street is an application of a greater principle, the greater principle being, I don't want you messing around in the road because you're not old enough to have the wherewithal to get out of the way when the car comes or whatever, you know? So what Peter's addressing is, in the first century marriage customs, you know, you had this thing where a young woman would have tremendous pressure to try and get a good marriage because that's how she was going to be taken care of financially. And so they would seriously run this rat race, a very dehumanizing rat race, where they had to kind of gussy themselves up for the meat market so they could have a decent marriage arranged. And Peter's saying, hey, we're not doing that. So the point is, when you start to get into some of the context and see what they're talking about, you get at what we sometimes call like the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law. And essentially what we're saying is that the letter of the law is often not the point. It's actually the spirit of the law that is the point all along. So we have a tendency, because it's normal for us, to view the text as the law itself that needs to be applied directly.
What I'd like to see then is, if you're saying that the statutory approach to what Peter was saying is, all right, daughter, oh, you did your hair too much. I need you to stop doing your hair that much. Oh, you got adornments on. Take those adornments off. And you're saying, no, Scott, that's a statutory approach to this. What then is the common law approach to what Peter is saying today?
Yeah, when you begin to view these things as common law type issues, you realize that what you're looking at in the text is an application of a principle.
Well, how am I supposed to know what the principle is?
Yeah, that's the task of interpretation when you approach Torah.
Like, okay,
it's
so
very difficult.
What are the actual elements involved then of getting at this, the principle behind the application? Like, what are the elements involved in that?
I think it's the same basic principles as when you talk about reading narrative in the Old Testament. You know, you have to account for what's going on in the flow of the thought of the passage.
Okay.
And you have to look at the broader themes of the book as a whole that okay. might come into play. And then, of course, if you have some basic knowledge about the world at the time or what their concerns were, that can often
so you're
really
saying
help.
You're saying context, and the context is the context of the book itself, and even more helpful in controlling, or at least as helpful in controlling your interpretation, is knowing the world that the utterance was spoken in, because it's speaking mm-hmm. application into that world.
Yeah, and isn't this what you kind of wrote about on that download we have on the website?
Yeah.
Okay, so this, I didn't mean for this to happen, but here's a nice spot for that plug. You should go on the website, pillarseminary.org, and download this thing. I don't, right?
Sure,
What's
sure.
it called? What is it on the website? How do we get to it?
Yeah, it's at blog.pillarseminary.org, and it's the blog on Joshua and the Battle of Jericho, actually.
Okay. Yeah, because there you do a good job of saying, like, okay, how do you understand something that – I'm screwing it up, but you get into how to get at understanding what people are
okay,
talking
so
about.
Okay, so then what do you think is an actual common law get me to a common law understanding of what Peter is saying.
So you look at the flow of what's going on in that passage, and he's essentially talking about different types of social relationships, you know, whether it's in the family or whatever it is, and how good relationships are going to function for believers in the first century world. It seems to be the broader theme of what he's after in that passage as a whole. And so he's pointing to the issue of how you get into a marriage in the first place. So if you don't really have any knowledge about how you get into a marriage or why in the first century world, you're more likely to walk away with something wonky out of that text. And I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but the basic gist is you had a meat market approach of arranged marriages. The bride's parents were often very concerned about making sure that their daughter was taken care of, but they could also be very concerned about their own economic well-being from dowries or bride prices or those those kinds of things. And then from the groom's family standpoint, they're wanting to do a good marriage that will result in good business relationships, or it's a way to solidify families, which can often mean businesses. And we just don't think about marriage that way. It doesn't even enter our grid.
So when Peter then says, don't adorn yourselves, the first century hearer goes, oh, shoot. And then they start triggering all these thoughts about this financial thoughts and these essentially exploitation thoughts of this young lady for the benefit of the rest of their family or whatever.
That is correct.
So then Peter's by saying then, don't adorn yourselves. Uh-huh. He is restricting their thought process, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds harsh, maybe. But the point that I'm trying to get at is we look at it and we see, don't wear makeup, jewelry, do your hair, wear nice clothes. And it all sounds very restricting on women from our cultural point of view. But when you take the time to go, wait a second, what's the principle that he's driving after? You begin to realize that it's actually a humanizing element. The whole marriage thing that he's counteracting was dehumanizing to women. And what he's saying is, we are not going to behave that way. So the spirit of the law there is a humanizing element towards women.
So you're saying that basically by doing the statutory law today, we could risk violating what he's actually instructing.
That
we could
correct.
Actually be dehumanizing towards our daughters.
Yes.
In effort to keep a law that was meant to keep us from being dehumanizing.
That is correct. So you take a common law given type law, you treat it statutorily, and you run a severe risk of doing the opposite of the intent of the law. Another way to say that is, in keeping the letter of the law, it's sometimes easy to violate the spirit of the law. And of course, this is what Jesus interacts with a lot with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and those groups.
Right. So you've made this claim that there's this statutory versus common law approach, and that the mm-hmm. common law approach is the mm-hmm. way to do it. Mm-hmm. Would you give corroborating evidence that this is how ancient people did this?
Yeah. So one of the big tips, initial tip-offs to the fact that this is how they handle it was when Hammurabi was discovered, most people pronounce it Hammurabi or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have these monuments that are often referred to as the Codex of Hammurabi or
right,
something
like
that.
The Law Code of Hammurabi.
Yeah. It's funny because it's not actually a law code, but the Code of Hammurabi kind of stuck because that's what we thought it was when we first discovered it. But you have these laws, you know, that even my kids, when they're in seventh grade social studies or whatever it is, and they have to do, you know, ancient-y things, and they have this thing. Well, this guy had this law code. You know, it's fun to read their textbooks and then kind of nerd out. But anyway, but what was super fascinating to scholars in the middle of the 20th century was we have no record of a legal case, an actual courtroom document, ever mentioning the Code of Hammurabi.
Wait, what, do you have like six courtroom documents, or do you have more than that?
We have thousands.
Okay, so thousands of courtroom documents.
Yes.
Not a single one references Hammurabi. Well, do they reference any other law codes?
So we have other law codes. That's point number one that you just alluded to. We have law codes that go back to pre-2100 BC all the way through Old Testament times. We have different law codes from different time periods. Not a single one of those law codes is ever mentioned in any legal document that records an actual decision in a courtroom.
Okay.
And we have thousands upon thousands of legal documents that date from that same time period, from, you know, Ur 3 documents, which puts it in 2000 to 2100 BC, all the way through Old Testament time.
So plenty of opportunities to actually reference this stuff, and it's never done.
Never. Not once. It's one of the rare moments where you can say, this never happens. Never does the recording of a legal decision mention in any way a written legal document.
So then you're forced to ask the question, what's the function of the written legal document.
Right, because obviously the document is not written to be the law that the juror consults, which again, to us, that's just how it works, right? You have the written law, that law is ratified through the legal process, now it's law, the jurors have to consult that law, refer to that law when they make their legal decisions. So you have thousands upon thousands of recordings of court cases, and they never mention a single written text, ever. And so this caused scholars to kind of scratch their head and be like, hey, you know, what's the deal? What are these things if they're not actual legal codes that are supposed to be upheld in a court of law? And what you see as you dig in is that you're dealing with more of what we would consider to be a wisdom text than a legal text.
I mean, getting at the principle of a thing.
Right. Right. So think of it this way. We think of law as I'm going to write down the actual law. And they think of law as there's a law or a legal principle, and I'm going to write down an application of that principle.
Or a
case study.
An example of the principle working itself out in real life.
Yes, exactly. And so all we get written down is the working out of the principle. And the interpretive process is to go back and try and figure out what the principle at play is.
All right. So then bring me back to Psalm 1 then.
Okay.
Tell me how then law becomes something I can delight in. the law of the Lord, the law of Yahweh. How is that then a point of delight or happiness?
Okay. So two quick things that I want to say in answer to that. One is that law isn't necessarily the best translation. It's not that it's a wrong translation. It's just that the word there, Torah, is really more about instruction. So the instructions of the Lord are worth meditating on day and night. You know, they are a delight to meditate on day and night. And the reason that's important is we have a tendency to think of law as only the things that sound like laws. You know, don't do this, do that. And if this happens, then you must do that. You know, it sounds like legal text. And so we see delight in the law of the Lord, and we kind of automatically trigger that legalese sounding
stuff.
We're
not thinking the entire book of Exodus. We're thinking Exodus 21 to 23.
Exactly. Exactly. But the psalmist would be thinking of all of that stuff, the stories and everything.
Right.
So that's thing number one that I would say. And then I forgot the question.
The question was, take me back to then, how am I supposed to be happy about the law of Yahweh? Oh.
Yeah, so here's the thing. We have a good father, and he wants to reveal himself to us. And you get to know the heart of the father by studying Torah.
Ah, I see what you're saying. So you're saying that Torah, or instruction, or even in these particular laws, whatever place in instruction, we actually get, if we could do kind of a comic book approach, we have God saying, all right, here's my principle, but I'm going to tell it to them in a particular application. So then you've got to look over the application and reason back to the heart behind the application.
That is correct. And in my opinion, the law, what we call the law, which we completely ignore, right? Because we think it doesn't apply to Christians. The law gives us a window into God's heart, his cares, his concerns, that I think is stunning. I would go so far as to say that I believe the church has shot itself in the foot by ignoring Old Testament law. We don't know God as well as we should or could because we do not know how to meditate on Torah day and night.
Okay, so I didn't want to spend too much time going through particulars because we'll do that for other episodes where we'll take a law and give a couple interpretations and wrestle with it. But for the meantime, can you give me a law or two, or can we go over a law or two that would demonstrate what you're talking about?
So quick examples.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the quickest and easiest example is don't muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain.
Why is that easy?
Because it's short and sweet, and it's referenced in the New Testament, so you can see how it works out. You can see how it is in Deuteronomy, and you can see how Paul uses it. So this is Deuteronomy 25:4.
All right, let's read it.
Okay, go ahead.
You shall not muzzle the ox. No, wait, hold on. You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain.
Pretty awesome, huh?
Yeah.
That's long and complex.
Right.
Yeah. So don't muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain. Now, look, a statutory approach says there's your exact law, so apply the letter of that law. So
what does that look like?
If I'm a believer and I don't have an ox, then I'm good.
So let's explain what the muzzled ox treading the grain would look like in real life.
You mean like what's the event being described?
Yeah, what's the event? Yeah.
Yeah, so you've harvested your grain, but now it's got to be tread so that the chaff can be separated from the actual usable kernel.
Right.
And an easy way to do that is to smash it somehow, whether that's with a grinding stone or, you know, an ox stomping on it.
Right.
Or whatever it is.
Okay.
But the goal is to get the husk or the chaff separated from the actual usable kernel.
So the law says don't clamp the oxen's mouth shut.
Right. Let the oxen snack when it wants while it's treading out the grain.
So God, having a limited set of limited paper he can use, is like, you know what's got to be in there for all of time?
Yes.
Don't muzzle the ox.
Right.
While it's treading out the grain.
He couldn't think of any bigger concerns he might have in life.
Right.
than the ox. Muzzling the ox.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you look at it and you're like, well, why, you know, like you just pointed out, why on earth would he pick that? The other thing is when you read these laws, it's very, very easy to come up with scenarios that aren't covered. You know, right. So you start reading goring ox laws and you're like, well, if somebody didn't put up the fence, if the ox wasn't a known gorer, and it's real easy to start thinking of scenarios that aren't covered by that law. And that's another tip to the fact that we're not dealing with statutory law.
Mm.
But so back to the treading the grain, don't muzzle the ox. So immediately you kind of start to get this sense there's got to be something more going on than just if I happen to have an ox and I happen to use that ox to tread out grain, then don't put a muzzle on it. And so that forces you to start asking the question, what's really at play? What is the spirit of the law? What is the intent behind this application of the law that I'm looking at?
So what does Paul have to say?
So when Paul references this passage, this one line, he does it twice, once in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and once in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And both times he's talking about paying pastors, for lack of a better term, paying kingdom workers. I don't know what's the right way
That'll
to say
work.
That.
That'll work, yeah.
Both times he's talking about people who labor on behalf of the church a livable wage. Or more so.
So how did he get from ox to people who labor on behalf of the kingdom?
Well, it's pretty simple. The principle at play is that you have this worker, the ox, and what you're saying is you have this worker working on your behalf, so honor that.
Hmm.
You know, and so when he's talking about people who work in the church, this is Timothy. He says, hey, those who labor on behalf of the church and do it well, they're worthy of double honor.
Hmm.
And then he says, you know, just as scripture says, don't muzzle the ox. Hmm. It's not that Paul's coming up with some new thing that was, you know, new ways to interpret the law now that we're Christians and the law doesn't apply anymore. No. He's interpreting the law the way it was meant to be interpreted in the first place.
So an ox law is not about an ox.
Right. I mean, and the only reason I hesitated is if you have a goring ox law and you had a scenario where there was an ox who gored, then it kind of is about an ox. But
but in all other scenarios. Right.
But so. Not muzzling the ox is... it's not so much about the ox. It's more about the principle, or, you know, the spirit of the law of, if you have somebody laboring on your behalf, then you better take freaking good care of them. And if you're not willing to take good care of the people who are, or the things that are laboring on your behalf, then you've got a serious problem. And the way this works itself out in the church today is we assume that our pastors, our parachurch workers, whatever, that they'll work basically for crap wages, because we want to make sure their motivations are right and that they're doing it for the cause of the gospel and not for material gain and all this kind of stuff. And so now we have this epidemic of pastors who have school debt so they could get training, and they make a crappy wage and they can't put anything into retirement. And it's just a horrible system. Why? Because we've ignored the law.
That was a tirade.
Yeah, I get kind of worked up about this one.
No, I mean, it sounds good. It sounds like, I mean, when Paul says, is it for the oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope, and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing the crop.
Right. And when he's talking about it in the Corinthian passage,
which that was 1 Corinthians 9.
Yeah. He goes on to say, I lost my train of thought.
I don't know what it was. Yeah, he says, shouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. He says, shouldn't those of us who are working for your spiritual good receive some material profit?
Right.
You know, it's totally counter to how we treat our pastors. It infuriates me. I have to be honest, this is a pet topic for me. It's really horrible. It's like we go around saying that the spiritual stuff is the most important. It's way, put the kingdom of God first. Everything kingdom of God and spiritual and about God is more important than your day in and day out, mundane, whatever. We talk like that. And then we take those people who are devoted to kingdom work, devoted to our spiritual good, spiritual growth, growth in the Lord, and we treat them like crap. That's counter Torah. It's direct violation of scripture.
So if I could just summarize what you're saying and tell me if I'm off on any of this. You're saying that there are two approaches to law. One is to look at law as this list of statutes that the law is actually, the words written down is actually the entire scope of that law. And then there's another law which says common law, which says, no, the law written down is trying to give you an example of a principle. And your job is to reason back to the principle using some of your the control of your thought as some of the context of both the book and their world. So the reason then I can delight in the law of Yahweh is because I'm getting to the principles that Yahweh thinks are important.
That is correct. Let you know God, know his heart. And then our job is to apply the principles.
Love it.
Not so much the letter of the law.
So I'm looking forward to future podcasts when we get to hash out a few of the more sticky laws in detail and discuss possible interpretations and applications. So good stuff.
Right on. Until then, please visit our blog at pillarseminary.org. And as always, feel free to comment. Send thoughts, questions, comments, concerns to podcast@pillarseminary.org.
Later.
Until next time.